Good to see everybody this evening. I was thinking after this morning we had so many that were off traveling that surely would have some of them coming back, but I think we had between 10 and 15 leave town this morning. I'm not sure what I said or if it was planned, but anyway, we've got a lot on the road. We want to keep them in our prayers, but it's great to see each one of you. It's encouraging to see you. We've got several that are just not feeling very good as well that we want to continue to remember also. Good to have our visitor here with us this evening also. It's just on a night where you're down to about half of what you normally have. It's great to have each one that come and appreciate your being here this evening. I want to look at an old lesson, one that you're familiar with, but probably we don't talk about a lot. It's found in Genesis chapter 11. One of the oldest accounts within all Scripture is the story, the historic story of the Tower of Babel, and I'd like to read that for you to begin the lesson this evening. Starting in verse 1 of chapter 11 of Genesis, "Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar, and they settled there. And they said to each other, 'Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly.' They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. They said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered all over the face of the earth.' But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that the men were building. The Lord said, 'If as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let's go down and confuse their language so that they will not understand each other.' So the Lord scattered them from there all over the earth, and they stopped building the city. That's why it's called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth." Now there's a lot of things here, but we have a lot of things that we were not told. How did God scatter them? Wouldn't you be interested to know that? The closest that we can tell as far as the time that this occurred was probably no sooner than 100 years after the flood, and it may have been several hundred years after the flood. And so it's important to understand that they now had the ability to make boats that would go a long, long way. In fact, ships, obviously, not just boats, but large ships. So did God scatter them that way? Were they scattered throughout the earth by building ships or by using ships that they had already built by this point? When you look at the map of the world, there's a lot of discussion among scientists about a continental drift that could be, not according to their timeline, but I've certainly heard people that have talked about the flood where that could have been because of the catastrophic change to the structure of the earth, that could have actually caused the continents to drift if in fact they did at that time or shortly after the flood. Maybe God used that. We don't know. We just know that men were scattered all over, not just the face of the known world, but the face of the world at this time. And so, however God did it, we can tell that it was something that was very efficient. The question becomes, why did God punish them for building this city, this tower, that they wanted to be something that was very prominent and very grand? And I think as we go back over it and look at it, there are some things that will immediately stick out to us. So let's go back over the first 4.5 verses. "The world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar," or Shiner, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, "settled there. They said to each other, 'Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly.' They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, 'Come, let us build a city for ourselves.'" And I think here we see the first problem. They want to build something that makes them glorified. They want a city for themselves. Now, there's nothing wrong with wanting to have something for yourself, but this appears to be something that goes way beyond just an accomplishment. This appears to be something that they want to make a name for themselves. They want to be known as the people that built the big tower. Whatever it was, they don't appear to have God involved in any way, whether for His glorification and certainly not for seeking His will. So that appears to be a big part of it. In James chapter 4 and verse 13, several thousand years later, James writes this. Starting in verse 13, "Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business and make money. Why, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it's the Lord's will, we'll live and do this or that. As it is, you boast and brag. All such boasting is evil." And kind of underline that in your mind. All such boasting is evil. Again, they wanted to do something that was spectacular so that men could look at them and say, wow, look at what they're doing. They're building something that is really great for themselves. This must be a really great people. This is something to keep in mind. Whatever we do, whether it's something, some kind of accomplishment that we want to do in life, I think it's entirely appropriate. As a matter of fact, I think it's entirely necessary that we develop the talents that God has given to us and that we use them as best we can, but to His glory. And so if you have a talent, you can certainly use it and hopefully develop it, but you do it for God's glory and not your own. Otherwise, there's a problem. And the second problem is this. There ought to be a determination among us that as we try to do anything that's significant, that takes a lot of our time and a lot of our resources, especially remembering that we're just here on this earth for a little while and that these resources are God's time and God's resources, then we need to be looking at it from a perspective of if it's God's will. And to the best of our ability, trying to find out what His will is. Again, if you came in a little bit late, we're in Genesis chapter 11. We're talking about the Tower of Babel and how God stopped that building. But again, their problem was they were trying to do something that made them look great apart from God's will, and that never works. Ever works. There's something else that I'd like to kind of point out here. In verse 15, when it says, "You ought to say, if it's the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that," understand that that is not necessarily giving the idea that every time we speak of a plan that we have, that we have to say, "the Lord willing." We'll hear that from time to time, and I really appreciate the attitude that people have on that, but I think that it can almost become an empty saying to us, a meaningless saying, if we say it without really thinking about it. Well, Carolyn and I, we went to Estes Park last week. We were looking forward to the trip. We went and got to see my mom and my dad. It was plans that we had made, and certainly we had the attitude, if it's God's will, we'll do this. But I don't think every time you say, "well, I'm going to the store," that you have to say, "the Lord willing." Or every time you say, "well, it's about time for bed, I'm going to bed, the Lord willing." Again, hopefully you have that attitude, but I don't think that we need to turn that into an empty, meaningless saying. It needs to mean something to us when we say it, but the attitude does indeed have to be there. And of course, that's what James, I believe, is trying to point out. When we do something great, again, significant with time or resources, that really needs to be foremost in our mind, and I think on the smaller things as well. In verse 17, he says this, "Anyone then who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it sins, because they did not include God's will within their plans to build the Tower of Babel, and because they were trying to glorify themselves rather than God, they sinned. The good they needed to do was to include God, as a matter of fact, to have God first and foremost in their thoughts." In Psalms, the 127th chapter in verse 1, this, by the way, is a song of ascents of Solomon, we're told. And so here we see one of Solomon's psalms, and he says this, "Unless the Lord builds the house, its builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchmen stand guard in vain. In vain you rise early and stay up late, toiling for food to eat, for He grants sleep to those He loves. Well, here we have a situation where if we're trying to do something big, but we're not trying to do it for God, then it's just kind of a vain thing. It's empty. You may get a little bit of praise from men. You may get a lot of praise from men. But if that's the only reason you're doing it, that's the only reward you get. when we do things significant, we really need to be having God in mind. Certainly, I believe that the context here more than anything is speaking of a spiritual house that we build for God, but it also pertains to physical things that we do. In 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 22, there's something within this passage that really underscores the idea of doing something according to God's will. And if we have that attitude, even if we're not even able to start something that we wish to do for God, we still have a blessing. And so look at 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 22. It comes after this. David wants to do something for God. He wants to build a house for him, a temple of worship that will house the Ark of the Covenant. And so he discusses these plans with Nathan the prophet, and Nathan, God reveals to Nathan that David is not the one to do this. And there are some reasons for this, but more than anything else, David was a man of war. He'd shed a lot of blood. And so David was not going to be the one to build a temple for God. But the idea that David wanted to do something impressive for God, the idea that David wanted to glorify God, was not something that God overlooked. As a matter of fact, God rewarded David, even though he wouldn't let him do this particular thing, God rewarded David quite a bit for just the desire to do something great for God, and especially for the desire to do it according to God's will, if it was his will. And so again, even though David didn't build the temple, look at verse 22 of 2 Samuel 7. How great you are, O sovereign Lord. There is no one like you. There is no God but you, as we have heard with our own ears. And who is like your people Israel, the one nation on earth that God went out to redeem as a people for himself and to make a name for himself? Hang on to that for a moment. I want to finish the passage, but this idea of making a name for himself is very important here. And to perform great and awesome wonders by driving out nations and their gods from your before your people, whom you redeemed from Egypt. You have established your people Israel as your very own forever, and you, O Lord, have become their God. Well, here we have this idea that when God does something or has his people to do something, it's so that he can be glorified, so that he can be honored. And this is something that David really appreciates, and he recognizes the fact that God is great. Again, in the preceding verses, Nathan tells David how God is going to reward David for his service and for his attitude, even though David did not build the temple. It was something that was very pleasing to God that he had thought of doing something great for him. But it was, I believe, even more pleasing to God that David consulted God first in order to find out what his will was. And because of that, David, as always, a man after God's own heart, with very rare exceptions, did it right. And because of that, because he sought to glorify God with whatever he did, he was honored. And again, this idea of God making a name for himself, this needs to be our attitude and our desire. Not like the people of Babel who wanted to build a city for themselves so that they could make a name for themselves. Our attitude needs to be, we need to do the best of our ability so that God may be glorified. In Luke chapter 14 and verse 10, we're given a warning on what happens when we attempt to glorify or to exalt ourselves. And Jesus uses a really simple example. In Luke chapter 14, verse 10, he says this. When you are invited, talking about a banquet. When you're invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he'll say to you, friend, move up to a better place. Then you will be honored in the presence of all your fellow guests. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Imagine if that had been the desire of the people of Babel, to humble themselves instead of to exalt themselves. Imagine if their desire had been to exalt God rather than to just leave him out of the equation completely. How they would have been honored. And Jesus points this out in something very simple. In Luke chapter 18 and verse 9, Jesus talks to others who are confident of their own righteousness. In Luke chapter 18, verse 9. To some who are confident of their own righteousness and look down on everybody else, you know anybody like that? Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to a temple to pray. One a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood up, prayed about himself. God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and I give a tenth of all I get. He's talking to the creator of the universe, and he's telling the creator of the universe how thankful he is that he's such a good guy, the Pharisee, that he does such wonderful things. Can you imagine anything so bold? And yet, now look at the tax collector's attitude. In verse 13, the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And then Jesus points this out. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home and justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. This is the motivation that we need to have. This was the exact opposite of the motivation that the people of Babel had. They wanted exaltation. They wanted self-aggrandizement. They wanted to be honored, and it backfired. God humbled them. Have you ever done anything that you thought, I am going to look really good in this? I can tell you, when I was a little kid, I played soccer. I played it for years before I finally realized I hate that game. It is boring. It is just, to me it was. Now, if you play soccer, that's great. But to me, I wasn't a fan of it. And it took me a long time to realize that. But we actually traveled to Canada, and we'd stay with a Canadian family, and then we would play against the Canadian teams. And we were there in Canada playing on a fairly big deal as far as lots of people watching, and I had broken loose with the soccer ball, and I had gotten all by myself, and I had, with my beautiful dribbling, beaten the goalie. He was way back there, and here I am standing at the goal, and I'm looking at the parking lot out there. There's not even a net on the back, because back then they didn't have nets, and so I thought, I'm going to kick this thing so hard, I'm going to kick it out into the parking lot. This is not going to be just a goal, but it's going to be impressive. And I just let loose, and that ball went straight up, hit the crossbar of the goal, and bounced back down. I didn't even score the goal. I just stood there with egg on my face, and not a very happy coach, I might add, or any happy teammates. They went from, oh, he's going to do it, to, oh, what a bum. But it was because I wanted to glorify myself. You ever done anything like that? Imagine what it would be like with the men and women who were involved with building the Tower of Babel. When people see this, they're going to say those people, they didn't call it Babel, God did, but they're going to say these people are just something special. And they end up to us today to be one of the most despised people, I suppose, of any that we read about. Because they were proud, because they wanted to boast, because they wanted to be seen of as great. And there's something there for us as far as having an attitude when we serve God, that attitude be one of humility. That attitude being of, if I have any success, it's because God allowed me to do that. If I have any talent that I can use for God, then I don't deserve the glory for it. God does. I need to develop it, but it came from God. If I have an opportunity to do something that other people can see and say, boy, that's kind of neat, it needs to be from an attitude of I want to do the best job I can for God so that God can be glorified. And if we'll do that, we will be honored by God. Even the very attitude, you may not be able to accomplish the great grand goals that you have to serve God in your life, because God may have different plans for you. But like David, he may be looking upon you and rewarding you just for the attitude and the love that you have. I want to conclude with a passage that's very familiar to us all, but it's found in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, and it talks about the way we build our lives. 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 10. Paul says this, "By the grace God has given me." Paul knew that he did not deserve to serve Jesus at all. Paul knew that he deserved not for Christ to have been crucified, but for Paul to have been crucified. And so he starts off his discussion by saying, "By the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as an expert builder, and someone else is building on it. But each one should be careful how he builds, for no one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ." You and I are going to build our spiritual houses on the foundation that God has laid for us as He's revealed through His apostles, through His prophets, through His disciples. But we've got to make sure that whatever we do in life, that we're building a spiritual house on the foundation of Jesus. And in verse 12, he reveals this. "If any man builds on this foundation using gold, silver, costly stones, wood or hay, or straw, his work will be shown for what it is, because the day will bring it to light." There's going to be a time where God shines a bright light upon the way you lived your life. And He knows whether or not you did your best, you used the costly materials in your spiritual life, or whether you tried to get by serving Him on the cheap and just tried to do the least you could do in order to get by. He says the light is going to bring it, or the day is going to bring it to light. It'll be revealed with fire, and fire will test the quality of each man's work. If what he's built survives, he'll receive his reward. There is a day of rewards coming. But if it's burned up, he'll suffer loss. He himself will be saved. Why? Because he still built his foundation on Jesus. He's still a Christian. But only as one escaping through the flames. Well, that's, I believe, something that if we can keep that in mind in relation to the events of the Tower of Babel, we'll do really well. I want to do the best I can with the resources God has given me to serve Him all my life. And even though I don't deserve it, if I do well, God will reward me for it. But if I try to get by, or if I try to do things for my own glory, there will come a point where I'll be humbled. Something I think we all need to take into consideration. Invitations open this evening. If you need to respond, if you have anything that you'd like to bring before the church, or if you'd like to become a Christian tonight, once you come forward, while we stand and sing.